Muslim, and voting for Trump today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Saba Ahmed is Muslim and a Republican, and she's supporting Donald Trump for president.
Hopefully he will tone down his anti-Islamic rhetoric, and we hope to see Muslims in his administration, and hopefully he'll be reaching out to our community.
Also, a closer look at how ISIS fighters use the internet.
Mostly it's a bunch of guys kind of LOLing at each other. They use a lot of emojis. It's what you'd expect in any sort of internet chat room, only this is ISIS.
Plus, the challenges of being the Yiddish advisor for the Oscar-winning film Son of Saul.
What's the difference between a Hungarian nya and a Yiddish nya? Do you say mishpuche? Do you say mishpuche?
Those stories and more coming up today here on The World. Glad you can make it here on this Friday. You know, given the comments made by Donald Trump about barring Muslims from entering the U.S., it's hard to imagine there are many Muslim Americans ready to vote for him. Saba Ahmed is trying to change that. She's Pakistani-American, a lawyer, and the founder of the Republican Muslim Coalition. Ahmed used to be a Democrat, but she switched to the GOP a few years ago. That's where she feels more comfortable, though she admits that party leaders don't make it easy for Muslim Republicans.
Well, a lot of us are very fed up with the policies and targeting of Muslims. Donald Trump recently talked about a Muslim ban. A lot of them talk about Islam and Muslims as if, like, you know, we're some outside group. But we're very much American citizens, and we just want to be part of the country. We're good law-abiding citizens, and we deserve to have a seat at the table. And I believe Republican leadership is behind us. Ryan's Priebus and Paul Ryan both spoke out against Donald Trump's Muslim ban, and I was glad to see that Donald Trump is backing out of his plans for us. And hopefully he will tone down his anti-Islamic rhetoric. And if he will be the GOP front runner and the nominee, we hope to have Muslims in his administration. And hopefully he'll be reaching out to our community.
You believe he'll do that because he continues to repeat his pledge to ban foreign Muslims from entering the U.S.?
He does. But I mean, as you saw just a couple of days ago, he started talking about it's just temporary and it was just a suggestion. And I think he is toning down his Muslim ban. It is unconstitutional, illegal. There are many federal laws that ban religious discrimination. And so we don't ever see it passing through Congress.
Donald Trump is now the presumptive Republican nominee. Are you saying you're going to vote for him?
We will be supporting the GOP nominee at the Republican Muslim Coalition. We hope to see a GOP candidate win the White House. And if Donald Trump ends up being the nominee, then yes, we will be supporting him.
But 6 months ago, you were protesting Trump precisely because of what he said about Muslims. But now you'll support him. Why the switch?
Well, I am still concerned about his policies. We can have disagreements about policies, but I think at the policy and a party level, we still will support the Republican nominee. I'm concerned about his anti-Islamic rhetoric, and that's why we're reaching out to him and the GOP establishment here in Washington, D.C. to educate them about Islam and Muslims, and if they can change their perspectives. And I think we have the opportunity to influence their policies this year. I don't see why we couldn't support them.
Another big switch for you, Saba, is that you used to be a Democrat and then switched to the Republican Party in 2012. Why'd you do that?
It was primarily because I couldn't support myself as a Democrat. I ran for office, and during the campaign, I was frequently asked about my policy positions. And a lot of the liberal values didn't align with my Islamic faith.
What kind of values?
We're very much pro-life, pro-traditional marriage, traditional family values, pro-business, pro-trade, and Islamic values are very much the conservative principles that the Republican Party stands for. Although some of our elected officials and GOP representatives may not reflect the core ideals of our party, but that is what the Republican Party is supposed to stand for, and we hope to bring them back towards that.
There are a lot of Muslims, though, who say that the tolerance and openness of the Democratic Party is where they feel most comfortable. You don't agree with that?
I mean, yes, that is a huge draw to the Democratic Party. They are much more welcoming to Muslims. However, when it comes down to their policy positions, I don't think that in terms of the national security debate and policies against Muslims are much different than Republicans. So therefore, it's very important for us to engage with both parties. And I think Democrats have a lot of Muslims within the party to lobby them and to influence them. But on the Republican side, there is very few. And that's why we formed the Republican Muslim Coalition.
You know, we hear a lot about how, like, the Latino vote is not a monolithic vote. There are Latinos on all political sides. Do you see yourself breaking this myth, too, kind of on the Muslim American side of things, that just because you're Muslim American, then you must be against Trump?
Exactly, right. 70% of our community voted for President Bush back in 2000. A lot of us have Republican roots, and many of our community supported Republican candidates precisely because of our Islamic values aligning with the GOP. But sadly, after 9/11, a lot of people left the Republican Party because they felt betrayed by Bush administration policies against Muslims. And what we're trying to do is bring them back into the party and hopefully influence and change the GOP narrative on Muslims.
Finally, you know, when Donald Trump says we're going to make America great again, what do you hear when you hear that?
I think we will make America great again for everyone, and that includes Muslim Americans. And we're hoping that the America that I see is going to be reflective of diversity and welcoming all people of all faiths, all backgrounds, and we will have a great country again.
Saba Ahmed is a Pakistani-American. She's president of the Republican Muslim Coalition, and she's supporting Donald Trump. Saba, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Saba says that Muslim Americans need to be much more politically proactive within the Republican Party. She wants Muslims in leadership positions, influencing policy from the inside. So what do you think? Should Muslims be doing more to change the GOP, and why? Saba is up on our Facebook page right now talking about this. Look for PRI's The World to join the conversation. Donald Trump has something to do with our next interview as well. It's about a website called Maple Match. It's not online yet, but it's getting a lot of attention. It will match up Americans and Canadians. Joe Goldman is the man behind the site. He's in Austin, Texas, and I asked him why he thinks his idea is resonating with so many people.
I think the sense of urgency that's been created by the Donald Trump candidacy has brought some interest to Maple Match. But ultimately, Maple Match has just uncovered something that's been there for a long time. Americans and Canadians have been really close together, both literally and culturally, for a long time. And I think there's something to this.
I know I've seen a lot of people, at least on Facebook anyway, who are not happy with the Trump candidacy and have, I'm not sure it's a joke, but it seems like a joke, said they're going to go to Canada. Is this a prank?
Maple Match is not a prank. Maple Match is an idea, and not everything that's funny is a joke. Maple Match is about connecting people, and we've seen more than 25,000 people sign up to this site, showing just how much they want to do that.
What is the ratio of Americans to Canadians so far?
Okay, we have over 5,000 Canadians signed up and about 20,000 Americans.
Why not start a site to urge Americans to stay and work on changing policy they're not happy with as a result of a possible Trump presidency? Why send the message that you ought to flee?
I think that the concept of Americans staying and working on policy is important. I'm a proud American. I've been involved lightly in politics for part of my life. My dad was a politician in Texas. And it's interesting to me to stay in the United States and work on policy. But ultimately, Maple Match is about connecting people. And the decision to move to another country is a difficult one, made between two people who love each other very much, and ultimately decide that moving to Canada, or maybe in some instances, moving to the United States is right for them.
If Trump does win, would you leave?
At this time, I'm currently signed up for Maple Match. I'm the first person on the list that we have. And if I find a Canadian partner and ultimately we decide moving to Canada is right for us, then that's what we do.
Joe Goldman, CEO of Maple Match, a dating site in development to match up Americans who want to meet Canadians, just in case, you know. Joe, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You might remember this year's Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film went to Son of Saul. It's a Hungarian movie about the Zoner Commando. These were the Jewish prisoners forced to lead other Jews to the Nazi gas chambers. The director wanted his characters to speak the languages they would have in real life, but he needed help with the Yiddish, which most Eastern European Jews spoke at the time. You won't find that many Yiddish speakers today. But the director found a man in Tel Aviv who spends his days making Yiddish come alive. Daniela Cheslow has a story.
Mendy Kahan presides over a library of 57,000 Yiddish books. It's an unusual setting, the fifth floor of Tel Aviv's grimy central bus station.
You have the buses shaking and the walls vibrating here, which reminds you every time that culture is not a secure and stable thing. Culture is a shaky thing which you have to uphold.
He would know. Mendy grew up in Antwerp, Belgium, speaking Yiddish at home. His parents were Holocaust survivors. In the 1980s, Mendy moved to Israel, where Hebrew is the predominant language, and he began collecting Yiddish books that people were throwing out. Now 52, he has piercing blue eyes, bushy eyebrows, and a receding mane of gray hair. And he smokes.
My Yiddish books, I must say, they survived gases. They survived ships and boats and sea and wars. And a little cigarette smoke will not hurt them.
There's also a stage between the shelves where Mendy hosts musicians and performs translated versions of standards like Fever. One day in 2013, Hungarian film director Laszlo Nemes walked into Mendy's library looking for help with Yiddish. It was for a film he was making that was set in the gas chambers of Auschwitz.
When I heard that he wants to make a Holocaust movie, I was hesitant. Like I said, no, another one is going to tackle the Holocaust in a movie. It's true that I would rather not. I would rather we do something else because it's such a difficult subject. But when I saw his work and when I saw the script, I understood that he has here an opening which no one has yet tried.
The movie tells the story of Saul, a Hungarian prisoner who escorts his fellow Jews into the gas chambers and then drags out the bodies. Mendy says for him, Yiddish is a language of life, so translating the dialogue into Yiddish was an especially dark experience.
Always when the theme of Holocaust just approaches, it's kind of an elevator taking me down, and something forces me to stay there, to look as much as I can.
Mendy also coached the Hungarian, German, and Polish actors in Yiddish, mostly through months of training over Skype.
What's the difference between a Hungarian nye and a Yiddish nye? Do you say mishpuche? Do you say mishpuche?
That's the Yiddish word for family. He says the most difficult part was recording Yiddish for scenes of death in the movie. Last week, the Tel Aviv Cinematheque screened Son of Saul on Israel's Holocaust Memorial Day. Ruti Fulweider was there. She's a computer graphics designer, and like most young Israelis, she doesn't speak Yiddish. She told me Yiddish might have been the glue for European Jews from the past, but today...
It's like a relic from a lost world, which is sad, but it's gone, and we have Hebrew to glue us together now.
Mendy Kahan says his life's work is to make sure Yiddish is not forgotten, especially in Israel. He's grateful for the chance to use Yiddish to make the Holocaust story more vivid, but he dreams of working on a film that depicts the rich world Yiddish speakers inhabited before the Holocaust.
I think we should make an historical movie in Yiddish, which would be like in the 16th or 17th century, and this would be like a beautiful movie showing the extent of Yiddish, and you would have the different Yiddishes and songs and things, and we have novels that we can base upon or...
But it would be a movie that most people would need subtitles to understand. For The World, Daniela Cheslow, Tel Aviv.
Coming up, the Navy lifts some of its limits on tattoos on the world. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has a few key allies in his country's civil war. There is Iran and more recently Russia. Then there's the Lebanese militia group Hezbollah. For several years, its soldiers have been fighting and dying in Syria. But today, Hezbollah lost its top military commander there. Mustafa Bedreddin was killed in an explosion outside Damascus. We've got our Middle East correspondent Richard Hall on the line with us from Beirut. How much do we know about what happened outside Damascus with Mustafa Bedreddin, Richard?
We don't know a whole lot at the moment, actually. We know for sure that he's dead, and we know that he died in Syria. But apart from that, we don't really know a lot. Hezbollah have been quite tight-lipped about who they think is behind it. Normally, when these things happen, Hezbollah is quick to blame Israel. And that hasn't happened this time. We've had one comment from a Hezbollah MP saying that Israel is behind it, but they said they're going to investigate it and figure out who is behind the attack.
Is there any sense that Bedreddin was specifically targeted or just swept up in a larger attack?
I think it would be a very big coincidence if it was a mortar attack or an artillery attack that managed to hit the top Hezbollah military commander. But we don't know at the moment. It could be.
We know Bedreddin was 55. He had quite a track record of carrying out deadly attacks going back decades. Tell us more about him. What do you know?
So he's been described by someone as the Frank Abagnale Jr. of Jihad. You may remember the character from Catch Me If You Can that Leonardo DiCaprio played. He was kind of a shadowy figure. I hate to use the phrase, but he's moved from country to country through the decades. He's been involved in all sorts of Hezbollah attacks. In 1983, he was thought to be behind an attack on the US embassy in Kuwait. He was actually sentenced to death for that attack and escaped from prison when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. When he returned to Lebanon, he was involved in attacks on Israeli troops there. And then later on, he took control of Hezbollah's forces fighting in Syria.
So, I mean, Hezbollah's been a major player in the Syrian civil war. It's been siding with the regime of Assad. What does the death of Hezbollah's top commander there mean for the situation on the ground?
I think operationally it'll deal a blow to Hezbollah and in turn to Assad. He was a very experienced commander. He had experience going back decades in commanding Hezbollah forces. On the larger scale, though, I don't think it'll have a huge effect on the course of the war in Syria.
Why do you think that?
Well, Hezbollah's main contribution isn't necessarily its tactical expertise, which is what Badruddin would have been responsible for. It's manpower, it's experienced fighters. So, like I say, a blow like this, a death like this might damage it operationally, it might lose some tactical expertise, but Hezbollah's real contribution is in its manpower and its fighters.
In Lebanon, though, where you are, Hezbollah is probably the most powerful military force. What's the sense in Lebanon about what Hezbollah is doing in Syria?
It's an interesting topic. I mean, when commanders like this are killed in Syria, it tends to have a galvanizing effect on Hezbollah supporters here. I mean, just today, an hour ago, there was a funeral for Badruddin in which it was attended by thousands of people in the southern suburbs of Beirut. It's more the drip, drip, drip of local boys dying, local Hezbollah fighters, young fighters dying in Syria that has an effect on the group and has an effect on public opinion here in Lebanon.
The world's Richard Hall in Beirut. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's talk tattoos for a moment, because if you've got one crawling up your neck, you might have had problems joining the Navy. It's got rules against that much body ink. But starting this month, the Navy is relaxing some of those restrictions. The Army did it last year, but the Navy's new policy goes even further, and it's all about attracting a new generation of military recruits. KUOW's Patricia Murphy has a story.
When the USS Toledo pulled into the Naval Submarine Base in New London, Connecticut, Adam Hillier's phone started ringing.
Thanks for your tattoo company. This is Adam.
He's a tattoo artist, and there's a naval tradition that after spending weeks at sea, sailors add a new tattoo to their collection.
They do generally gravitate toward tattoos that can be done in one sitting.
Some sailors want body art that makes a bigger statement.
It's almost like a religious thing for them.
Count Navy Petty Officer First Class Mike Spittler among them. His uncle was a tattoo artist, and many of the tattoos on his legs are from him. A castle, a wizard, a dragon. His right arm is a nautical-themed sleeve, a tribute to his wife.
There's a lighthouse with Poseidon on it, who's the god of the sea, and under it says, guide me home. So it kind of reminds me to, wherever travels take me, she's my rock. That's where I come home to.
And today, Spittler's back in the chair. Adam Hillier is shading in an ornate caricature of a fortune teller on Spittler's left arm. The piece is large enough that the fortune teller has her own tattoos.
Yeah, well, it's a black and gray piece, but her tattoos are blue, so they stand out on her.
Tattoos are such a big part of Spittler's life that he's not just a client here. He actually owns this place, which he balances with his shore duty in the Navy.
You ready, ma'am?
Yep.
The Navy's policy change allows Spittler and other sailors to get more tattoos and larger ones. Tattoos can now extend below the elbow and knee. And for the first time, sailors can have tattoos up to an inch on their necks. The new rules are the most liberal of all the armed forces. At the Office of Navy Personnel, Lieutenant Commander Nate Christensen says the Pentagon's commitment to professional appearance hasn't changed, but young people have. He says strict tattoo limits made it hard to recruit.
This policy change really is about being honest with ourselves and ultimately putting policies in place that reflect tattoo realities across America.
Of course, while millennials are getting more tattoos, body art is nothing new in the Navy. At the Puget Sound Navy Museum in Bremerton, Washington, there's a whole exhibit devoted to maritime tattoo history. Curator Megan Churchwell traces it back to the 1700s.
You would use the big needles that you used to sew a ship's sail, and then you'd dip it in the ink and then poke it into the skin.
At the time, tattoos were more practical than decorative, a sailor's initials, and maybe his birth date, so his body could be identified if he died at sea.
It was a very painful process. This was on a ship using unsterilized materials that you just had on board with you.
There were few formal content restrictions until 1909, when the Navy issued the first regulations against obscene tattoos. After that, the voluptuous bodies on pinup girl tattoos had to be clothed just enough to get by. Still, Navy tattoo policy has always been subjective. When Spittler joined, some of his tattoos were already bigger than regulations permitted.
I was required to go and sit down in front of a pretty high-ranking officer at the time when I was doing my initial contract and my paperwork, and just explain to them the meaning behind all of my tattoos. At that time, they weren't writing waivers for tattoos that were possibly gang-related or had some kind of negative meaning behind them.
Spittler is happy to see the regulations loosened. He says there's no reason to exclude people from jobs simply because of their body art, even if they have as much as he has, both legs, his right arm, and now his new fortune teller ink on his left arm.
In the meaning of tattoos, that represents good fortune. And eventually this whole arm is going to have to do with my family. So at the top, it just made sense to have something that represented good fortune.
Even with the Navy's changes, some tattoos are still taboo. No head tattoos, no symbols of gangs or extremist groups, and no obscenity. For The World, I'm Patricia Murphy.
Patricia's story is part of the American Homefront Project. It reminds us of a guy in Texas named Daniel Aguilar, a military man covered in tattoos. We brought you a story a couple of years ago here on The World. We've reposted it and the incredible photos of his body art up on our Tumblr, pritheworld.tumblr.com. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Off the coast of Wales, a diver searches the seabed. He's looking for gold from a long-lost shipwreck. And for 7 summers, he finds nothing. And then he finally spots a nugget.
I just stared down at it like, wow, you are the most beautiful thing I've ever seen.
A wow worth 70,000 bucks. That's ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. 6 months ago, a group of ISIS gunmen targeted a lot of people just going out for a Friday night in Paris to meet friends, see a soccer match, hear a concert. 129 people were killed that night. In many ways, Paris feels like it's returned to normal. Last night, a cafe was packed with people, the same place where 15 people were gunned down in November. But for the people who lived through the attacks, the memories are still painful. Aurelia Gilbert was in the Bataclan Theater on November 13th. She remembers texting her husband to tell him that she was alive.
We were just hearing the noises, first the noise of the bullets and the shouting and people crying, and then everything went quiet. So I decided to text my husband to send him those texts that you'd never expect to send your family.
I gather you know CPR and a few other emergency first responder procedures. What were you thinking about when you were in the Bataclan? Were you thinking maybe I could save some people?
Exactly. When I saw people really badly hurt, the first thing you think when you see them bleeding, I have to save them. And that's a good thing because it prevents you from thinking too much to what would happen to you.
How were you finally able to escape? I know you managed to get out the front door. Was it just a lull in the shooting and that was it?
After the terrorists came in the venue and they began to shoot, I was laying on the floor with several hundreds of people. And when they stopped shooting and began to climb to go to the balconies, this is how I was able to hide myself. But after 2.5 hours, the cops came into the venue. So we go through the main entrance, and we had to go through that terrible place where we see all the corpses of the dead people around us.
Well, unlike scores of people that night, you walked away from the Bataclan with no physical injuries, but the psychological impact, what's that been like for the past 6 months for you?
I was quite okay. I had no nightmares, but I could not pretend that nothing happened. This is why I thought it was important for me to help other people by creating an association of the victims of those terrorist attacks.
Right, that support group that you're involved with for victims and families of the November 13th attack, what are you hearing from them? What do they need most of all right now?
At the moment, 6 months after the attacks, the people who lost their kids, their husband, their wife, their brother and sister, they are still in shock. They are grieving, actually. Some are really, really angry. And they also have issues that they are facing that we are trying to sort. Like, for the people who are, for example, in wheelchair, they have to change their home so they can be for disabled people now. And we want to make sure that the French state will pay for it.
Aurelia, do you think France is doing enough to prevent terror attacks in the future?
It's a good question. I've been really thinking during the last 6 months to the three people who came into that venue. They were French. They were not coming from a foreign country. They were not bringing a foreign war. Those guys, they were French. And I really want to know where, as a French society, where we lost those guys. When they had no more hope, and the only hope they had was to go to Syria, join ISIS, come back and kill us. So I will not blame exactly the French government for everything. You cannot put a gunman in front of every venue, every school, every church. This is not the way we behave in France.
So what do you think the solution is to keep French from killing other French?
We have huge discussion in France at the moment. I'm truly convinced that we should bring a society where people could not see their future into killing other people.
I'm curious, were you able to attend the concert in February when the Eagles of Death Metal returned for that commemorative show?
Yes, I was at this concert, and it was really important because we were, for the first time, all together gathered, including the families of the people who died. And we all decided that we want to go to that show and finish it, and we did it.
Yeah. I partly asked because of what you just said. You can't put police in front of every concert venue. And lead singer Jesse Hughes of Eagles of Death Metal stirred up controversy in February when he said the massacre may not have occurred if everyone in the theater had guns. What did you think of that?
I've been into that venue, and they had Kalashnikovs, three guys. Even with a gun, there would have been more blood and more dead people. I'm truly convinced of this.
So today in Paris, on the six-month anniversary of the attacks on November 13th, what's the mood today?
There is no official celebration, but I'm thinking about the 130 people who died that night, because now I know their parents, their brother, sister, sons, wife. And now it's like if I've lost 130 friends. So I'm really thinking about them today.
Aurelia Gilbert is a survivor of the November 13th, 2015 Paris terror attacks. She was inside the Bataclan nightclub when shooters opened fire there 6 months ago today. Aurelia, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
We've been remembering the Paris attacks on our Instagram account today, posting images from that night as well as stories about how some lives have changed since then. You can find them at The World on Instagram. ISIS's ability to attack Paris took a lot of people by surprise, and now it looks like it's ramping up on another front. Shira Frankel is BuzzFeed's cybersecurity reporter. She spent 6 months combing the internet for clues about how ISIS operates online, and she just published a story called Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About How ISIS Uses the Internet. So, Shira, start with the kinds of digital tools ISIS is using and why they choose them.
So I have to sort of preface this by saying that 99% of ISIS are probably not using the internet for anything more sophisticated than, you know, occasionally going onto Facebook or Twitter or whatever and saying hi to their mom. The sophisticated part of ISIS, the 1% that probably knows what they're doing, that is training on these things, they're basically using everything. They're using Tor, they're using VPNs, they're using encrypted emails, they're using dating sites. So they're really flexible. But at the same time, because they're so flexible, because they're on so many platforms, they're not necessarily savvy, according to cybersecurity experts, about how these platforms work and what the details are.
So dating sites? What kind of traction are they getting on dating sites?
So we found a young woman in Jordan who had been lured to join ISIS through a dating site. And we spoke with Jordanian officials, and actually they were really concerned about ISIS recruiting off of Islamic dating sites that are really popular in the Middle East.
Are there any ISIS attacks or plots we know of that have been aided or accelerated because of their skills online?
We don't have any evidence at this point. There have been rumors, there have been leaked intelligence reports saying that ISIS did use the dark web, so-called, what they really mean is just PGP encrypted emails, to plan the attacks in Paris and Brussels. But the more we've looked at it, the more it seems like if they did use those tools, they probably didn't use them correctly. And more likely than not, they were using very old school methods of that have been used by terrorist organizations for years. Stay in the same apartment, communicate person to person, use a bunch of burner phones that you can easily throw away afterwards. And what worked 20, 30 years ago still works today.
There's this debate within ISIS that you were kind of reporting on about how to keep communication secret. And you managed, for example, to follow a series of messages between two guys in ISIS. And one asked the other, brother, are you? Use VPN for site. No, brother, that is expletive. Use Tor. And the other responds, Tor is a creation of CIA, avoid Tor. So, I mean, how'd you manage to listen in on that conversation?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time on these channels that they use, whether on an app like Telegram or on different apps that they've been active on. And I find it interesting that a lot of these channels are just a bunch of dudes kind of mansplaining the internet to each other. It could be Reddit for all anybody knew. I mean, occasionally there's the, you know, gruesome videos and the photos being shared. And obviously they're all there with a quite similar ideology. But mostly it's a bunch of guys kind of LOLing at each other. They use a lot of emojis. It's what you'd expect in any sort of internet chat room, only this is ISIS.
Given how fast things are changing on the net worldwide, is ISIS keeping up with the pace of change in its bunkers in Raqqa?
They are. I mean, what ISIS has proven itself to be very good at is flexibility. As soon as one thing is shut down, they move on to another. The moment that Twitter got serious about shutting down their accounts, they were on Telegram. Part of what ISIS sees itself doing is using the internet to recruit across the world. And we're seeing that in Bangladesh. We're seeing that in Myanmar, in the Philippines, of course, in the United States and in Europe. And the internet has allowed them to do this in a sort of unprecedented way.
How exactly are the U.S. and its partners trying to fight back?
So a lot of the U.S. intelligence officials I spoke to talked about how them going online was actually a gift for intelligence. So it's what they want. The more that they're online, the more of a digital footprint they leave, and the more that intelligence agencies in Europe and the United States can trace them and follow them. I mean, they do what I do, right? They find these channels and they lurk there.
Terrorism has created, you know, some tension between privacy and security. For example, ISIS uses some of the same tools as activists like Edward Snowden. Could the offensive against ISIS affect other groups that use secret encrypted communication?
So there's a lot of concern among privacy activists that with ISIS using these tools more and more, it's going to foster a backlash against them. One of the things I noticed in a Telegram, ISIS Telegram channel I was following, was how often they did link to activist sites. There are so many privacy groups in the United States that are thinking about safe ways to communicate online. And they're doing it because they want to be able to communicate to civil liberties groups. They want to be able to communicate to human rights organizations in the developing world. ISIS is watching those groups and saying, huh, they're really smart about how they communicate online and how they keep people safe. We can literally take their manuals, their advice, translate that into a multitude of languages, distribute it on our sites, and follow that advice. You know, these tools can definitely be used for evil. We've seen criminals be interested in them, but they're also used for a lot of good.
Shira Frankel reports on cybersecurity over at BuzzFeed. Shira, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Our next story weighs in at a mere 3 ounces, but those 3 ounces are worth more than $70,000 because they're 3 ounces of gold. This nugget wasn't found in California or the Yukon. This shining moment happened on the seabed off the coast of Wales, and it was discovered by a 60-year-old prospector, Vincent Thurkettle. Mr. Thurkettle, thanks for being with us. Before we get to the backstory here, just tell us what it was like to suddenly find this 23-carat hunk of gold.
Do you know, it was the calmest moment. There was a scattering of gold dust on the seabed, and I was swimming along, looking at it, being all calm and calculating, and then all of a sudden there was this lump. I just stared down at it like, wow, you are the most beautiful thing I've ever seen, other than in museums.
You didn't reach for it right away. You kind of waited,
no,
right?
No, I would say I didn't touch it for 30, 45 seconds. I had the presence of mind, as it were, to want to remember it. I didn't want to snatch it. I'd looked down at it and I thought, you've been there for 160 years since this ship went down. The last person who touched you is now dead, probably died horribly. And here you are lying there in a crack in the bedrock, glowing beautifully. And yeah, it was just magical. I just want to look at it for a while. I mean, you'll know, people in Britain don't understand gold as well as Americans, but there is such a thing as gold fever. And my mother says I've got it.
Yeah, I think people around the world probably understand the power of gold pretty well. So this was part of a shipwreck. Tell us about the history of the ship and how long you've been scouring the seabed there in Wales.
So on this particular wreck, it sank in 1859, bringing gold prospectors back from Victoria in Australia, where there was a massive gold rush. And this ship was thought to be carrying about $150,000 worth of gold. She went down, all the women died, all the children died, about 450 men died, and about 220 of them were prospectors. So there was an extraordinary amount of gold down there. And I thought, even if the 160 years of salvage, even if they've got 99%, there's still well over $1 million worth down there now.
Now, you found this back in 2012. Why'd you keep quiet about it?
Yeah, that's important. I get asked that a lot. But I'd found this gold, and all I wanted to do was be quiet about it, because there was always a chance that there was a whole load more down there. And I would have felt a right idiot if I'd surfaced, waved it about, shown everyone, and then someone else had jumped in and found a sort of 2-pound lump next to where I'd just been.
This 3-ounce nugget you found on the seabed of Wales, this was a brief shining moment. You did not get to keep it. Why not?
In Britain, anything found on the foreshore is property of the crown. So because this nugget was found close to low tide, it almost immediately became property of the crown. And then the crown agents will think about it all with a government authority called the Receiver of Wreck over here. And they're now considering and working out which museum it goes to. You know, loads of people have said I should have just kept quiet about it, but forever. But yeah. If I'd kept quiet about it forever, I wouldn't have the story to tell. I couldn't write a book. I couldn't show it on television. And I thought, you know, I had the joy of finding it. If it ends up in a museum and nothing to do with me anymore, well, that's fine. I don't mind that. I mean, I was diving with family and friends, and we've had a great 7 summers. I've got a nephew and niece in America, and they've flown over from Virginia to, that reminds me, it's Liam's birthday this weekend. Let's get him a card. What I'm saying is this is family fun. People think it's about money, and of course money's involved. We've all got bills to pay. But it was a great family adventure for 7 summers. Most of my friends and most of my family have been involved with the boat and diving on this shipwreck. And it's also not just nuggets. We found loads of stuff like knives and forks and spoons and bullet molds and old diving weights and all sorts of stuff. I began just looking for the gold and gold dust and bits of treasure, and I've ended up absolutely fascinated by the history and all the artifacts that are coming off the wreck.
Vincent Thurkettle, the man who's found the biggest gold nugget ever in Britain, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, why Haiti is joining the African Union here on The World. CDI. Those 3 letters in France mean so much in the labor market there. They stand for contract of indeterminate length. In other words, once you get a CDI job, you're pretty much set for life. Even if you don't perform as well as you should, even if your company is losing money, it's really hard to get fired. But now the French government is trying to make that easier. Pamela Druckerman wrote about this for the New York Times. She lives in Paris. Now, the thing apparently that managers have been turning to is this practice of putting somebody in the closet or le placard. What does that actually mean?
So when you can't fire someone, and this mostly happens in really big companies, you put them in the closet, which means you try to make them so miserable that they'll just decide to quit in the end. I read about a banker who got to work one day and found that his desk had been moved into a hallway, and he sort of gradually realized that his colleagues had been told not to talk to him at all.
Wow.
A friend of mine is in the closet right now at his company, and basically his boss stopped replying to his emails. You reach a point where no one can tell you you're in the closet because it's technically illegal to do that. It's considered moral harassment, but you eventually figure out that that's what's happening, and it can last for years.
But now I hear the French government's trying to change their laws to make it easier to fire people. What are they proposing, actually?
The latest rule has a number of provisions, but one of which basically defines the economic conditions under which you can fire someone instead of leaving it quite ambiguous. So it says basically if a company is losing money for a certain number of quarters, you're allowed to fire people.
This has not gone down well, I gather, with a lot of people in France.
You know, people in France, some 60 to 70% of the population opposes the new labor law with this provision making it easier to fire people, slightly easier to fire people. But interestingly, it's not just, you know, we always hear about French labor unions and they're so active. They only represent really 10% of the workforce. This is a population-wide opposition. Even the employers' unions who were initially pushing for the labor law are now against it because they don't think it goes far enough.
Now, if it's hard for managers to fire those permanent employees, then a lot of French employers just hire people on temporary contracts, and I'll bet they go to a lot of young people. And that must have an almost paralyzing set of consequences. What is the practical side of all that?
Well, nobody wants to hire anyone because you basically, when you take someone on, you're hiring them for life. I mean, I talk to small business owners all the time. I had an electrician come to my house the other day, a guy in his 50s, and I asked him, you know, he was all alone. I said, do you have anyone helping you? He said, I can't risk hiring someone on a permanent contract because then I'll be responsible for them forever.
But why can't he hire on a temporary contract?
You can only renew those a certain number of times, once or twice. So you train someone and then, you know, in a year and a half, they're gone. Plus, when you finally end their temporary contract, he said there are all kinds of charges there, too. So this guy, he said, just forget it. I'm not hiring anyone. It's too much trouble.
It really sounds like the system is not working in France. People being sent to the closet can't be very efficient. Why are people fighting so hard to keep the system in place?
I think there are a number of reasons. And one of them is simply that people are just so used to the system with the permanent contracts. And the whole society is structured around having a CDI, a long-term contract. So you can't get a mortgage, get a car loan, rent an apartment, sort of do all take all the steps that you would expect to take in your 20s and 30s as a young person without a CDI. You just kind of get stuck. And it's a sign that you're growing up, that you're becoming an adult. So that these youth protesters are in part just saying, you know, we want to go through the passages that our parents have gone through.
Pamela Druckerman wrote about the challenges facing jobs for life in France for the New York Times. Pamela, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Finally today, the African Union has 54 member states. Make that 55 pretty soon. Next month, Haiti will officially become a member. Yep, Haiti in the Caribbean will become part of Africa. Joining me now on the line is Gary Pierre-Pierre, publisher of the Haitian Times in Brooklyn. Gary, Haiti's 4,000 miles from Africa. Why does it want to join the African Union?
Well, you know, Marco, Haiti always calls itself as a little piece of Africa in the Caribbean. So I think it's only fitting that now they made it official because we share so much the African culture, from our religious practices to the way we interact. I know you lived in West Africa and Togo, so did I. And when I lived there, it reminded me so much of Haiti. It was uncanny. So I think it's only fitting that now Haiti decides that it's going to join an organization that it has a lot of in common with.
Right. Well, we met as Peace Corps volunteers in West Africa. I mean, the African Union exists for many reasons. One of them is economic. How will Haiti benefit economically from this relationship?
Well, I think it's a great opportunity for Haiti. Right now, Haiti wants to develop a lot of industries, tourism one of them, and it has huge building boom going on. And so I think there's a lot of opportunities for commerce, for raw material that is plentiful in Africa, and just cultural exchanges. I think Africa, a place like the Congo, they very much been part of Haiti. If you go to the Congo, a lot of the professors there in the 60s and the 70s were Haitians. And so the bond is really tight. And I think economically, it's an opportunity for Haiti to find a place to get some of the products that it desperately needs.
Do you think the symbolism will be more important in the long run than what it actually results in, this relationship and the African Union membership?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's probably more cultural than anything, I think, at this point. But I think as Africa develops its industries and it'll be looking for markets, and Haiti will be one of them. I think right now, it's still, like you said, it's symbolic. But I'm hopeful. I think in the long term, it'll be, you know, 20 years from now, looking at it like, oh, what a brilliant move this was. Why it took it so long?
Gary Pierre-Pierre, publisher of the Haitian Times in Brooklyn. Thanks for your time.
Anytime, Marco. Thank you.
Culturally, there are a lot of connections between Haiti and Africa. Next month, you'll be able to hear a whole collection of them on the CD Tambou Toujours Lou. It features some of the musical innovation in Haiti in the 60s and 70s, discovered in private music collections from Port-au-Prince to Brooklyn. And if some of these tunes were sung in any number of West African languages, you'd think they were from Senegal or Mali in the 60s. This is one example from the ensemble Étoile du Soir. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. Eric Goldberg composed our theme music. I'm Marco Werman, and we'll see you back here on Monday.
Madame, moi, c'est pas m'lié, moi, pas mettre mon veilleur, yo, si t'as fait tripotage, parce que ouais, Mbappé travaille. Allez,
allez, me disez-vous. PRI, Public Radio International.